So now we're going to go from undernutrition to overnutrition, to determinants of overnutrition, and going to Mexico from Africa. So I'm going to be talking today about a study on the influence of indigenous status and community indigenous makeup on obesity and diabetes among Mexican adults, as Jean said. And in terms of disclosures, I'll read this: the following personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation existed during the past 12 months. I have no relationships to disclose. So in many high-income countries, obesity and diabetes are more prevalent in indigenous than non-indigenous populations. For example, among the Native American population here in the US versus the majority non-Hispanic white population. You also see that in Canada among the First Nations people. But the opposite pattern may be true in some lower and middle income countries. But there have been few large scale studies of this in these settings by indigenous status. And in addition, there hasn't been much examination at all of the impact of community indigenous composition on these or other outcomes, even though there's been extensive study of community minority composition on health outcomes in higher income countries. So insights into these patterns, as well as underlying explanations, can inform us about strategies in lower and middle income countries aimed at preventing obesity and diabetes in both indigenous and non-indigenous populations and communities. So we examine these patterns in Mexico, which is an upper middle income country in North America. It's an important case for investigation. First, it's home to the largest indigenous population in Latin America. And obesity and diabetes have really reached alarming levels in the Mexican population, approximately 30% for obesity and 7.5% for diabetes, so very close to levels that you see in much more developed countries. And there's also been extensive development in Mexico over the last several decades. And because it is an upper middle income country and has experienced all this development, insights into patterns there around indigenous characteristics may have implications for lower income countries in the region as they develop. So a little more on Mexico's indigenous population. It numbers about 13 million, which is around 13% of the population. It's very diverse, with 62 languages. The population is extremely disadvantaged, with more than four times the number living in extreme poverty relative to the non-indigenous population, and nearly half the education level on average. Health outcomes generally are much worse in the indigenous population, with lower life expectancy, higher infant mortality. And indigenous populations tend to be more rural, more isolated, and less developed. They're clustered in the south, and let's see if I can do this, here in the south, and less so, but also in central Mexico. These tend to be, especially the south, less developed and more rural. More rural communities are located there. So unlike many other health outcomes, indigenous status may offer some protection against obesity and diabetes in Mexico. And this may be due to the severe socioeconomic disadvantage among indigenous individuals that I just talked about. And unlike in higher income countries, socioeconomic disadvantage in Mexico has been found to deter adoption of unhealthy lifestyles, although this varies a bit by urban and rural status. Poverty may mean that energy-dense diets, for example, and labor-saving devices are less affordable. The indigenous are also more likely to work in agricultural and other manual occupations, which may result in greater energy expenditure in indigenous than non-indigenous adults. And there may also be some community-level mechanisms in operation that result in lower obesity and diabetes levels in communities with a higher share of indigenous individuals. The political disempowerment of indigenous groups and their rural and isolated locations may have resulted in fewer resources dedicated to development in these communities, and those lower levels of development may have constrained changes to the nutritional and physical activity environments that are seen in more developed communities in Mexico. And this may buffer all residents against obesity and diabetes, whether indigenous or non-indigenous. So to date, there have been no large-scale studies of these topics in Mexico, But smaller area studies have found less obesity and diabetes in indigenous adults than have been reported in studies of the general population. And a recent study based on nationally representative data found lower obesity prevalence in states with larger indigenous populations like Chiapas and Oaxaca. And also lower prevalence of overweight has been found in indigenous than non-indigenous children. Also, indigenous adults consume more fruits and vegetables than non-indigenous adults, which, as we know, reduces risk for obesity and diabetes. So we address two questions. First, are obesity and diabetes less prevalent in indigenous versus non-indigenous adults in Mexico? And are they less prevalent in communities with a higher percentage of indigenous residents? Then we ask whether or not these differences are explained by socioeconomic disadvantage among indigenous adults and by lower community development in communities with a high percentage of indigenous residents. So we use the Mexican Family Life Survey for this study, which is the first wave. It's a longitudinal study. It's representative of Mexican households and communities. The survey actually has a lot of rich information on socioeconomic status, which is one of the reasons that we chose it. It also oversampled rural households, and indigenous individuals are more likely to live in rural households. So this gave us a really nice large sample of indigenous adults. The survey sampled all indigenous individuals and households, and we had a nice large sample of adults, which we defined as age 20 or over, in 150 communities. So the definition of community that we used was localidades, which is a sampling unit that's used in the Mexican census. And these range in size from very small rural areas to larger cities or parts of cities. So we looked at obesity, which was based on measured height and weight. That's a body mass index of 30 or higher. Diabetes was based on self-reported diagnosis from a clinician, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Our primary predictors of interest were indigenous status, and I'm going to just read you a little bit more about that. So in the term indigenous status is highly contested, and it generally incorporates concepts related to things like ancestral occupation of land, separation from colonizing peoples, language, culture, self-identification, and group recognition. And in Mexico, official estimates until recently have been based on the ability to speak an indigenous language. But that's been argued to underestimate population size. And in response to pressures from indigenous peoples organizations, the government included a question on self-identification in the 2000 census. So whether or not this respondent identifies themselves as a member of an indigenous ethnic group. And this identified a significantly larger indigenous population in Mexico. So given this change, we use this definition based on self-identification. And we also did a sensitivity analysis, which I can talk about if you're interested, based on the language definition, which was a smaller percentage. So there's about 13% who were indigenous based on membership in an indigenous ethnic group, and a smaller percentage, about 9%, based on language ability. And we defined percent indigenous in the community based on an aggregate of this variable and community size. So in terms of mediators, what are called mediators or explanatory variables around individual level SES, we used three measures. The first was a measure called, it's a household economic status measure. It's called household consumption expenditure. And this measure tends to be sort of the gold standard in developing countries. So it measures expenditure on foods and non-food goods and services. So this incorporates food access in the household and access to labor-saving devices. Occupational status was measured in broad categories: agricultural, manual, other manual, and non-manual, and education was also measured in categories. At the community level, we included several indicators of community-level development. These were paved roads throughout most of the community, and these were reported by community leaders. The presence or absence of public transportation, same thing reported by community leaders. The percent of households owning motorized vehicles, and that was designed to indicate community capacity, road capacity as well, in terms of supporting motorized vehicles, and also median household economic status as a measure of the kind of affluence in the community and attraction in terms of, you know, sort of marketing and things like that, in terms of a market in the community. So we controlled for a number of individual covariates. I'm not going to go through them, but I did want to talk a little bit about diabetes because it's dependent on access to a clinician, self-reported diabetes. We included several measures of health insurance, health access and use in the models for diabetes, and those included health insurance, household expenditure on healthcare in the last 3 months, and then participation in a poverty alleviation program, which increases access to preventive care. So those were sort of a control to get at more true diabetes prevalence. At the community level, we also included a number of covariates, urban, rural, location, and regional location. And for diabetes, again, we included some controls for healthcare access in the community, like number of health facilities. Analysis, we used univariate and bivariate analysis and estimated logistic regression models for a sequence of models, which I'll show you in a minute, for each outcome. These were multi-level models that were intended to account for clustering in communities. The responses were also clustered in households, and we ended up not finding much there, so we just used a random intercept for communities. So this first table is really just designed to communicate the lower SES of indigenous versus non-indigenous adults in Mexico. So you can see, I'll just point here. So in this column here, these are indigenous adults, and over here, non-indigenous adults. So starting with household consumption expenditure, so you can see there's about twice the expenditure in adults who are non-indigenous are living in households with approximately twice the expenditure as indigenous adults. And then here in terms of occupational status, you can see that indigenous adults are about three times as likely to work in agricultural occupations, which have a lot more energy expenditure. In terms of education, about half of the indigenous adult population has a third grade education or less, relative to about a quarter of the non-indigenous population. So much lower SES in the indigenous than non-indigenous population. So here are some statistics for sampled communities by community percent indigenous. And what we did here was broke community percent indigenous into three categories just for these descriptive statistics. So in the first column here, these are communities with less than 10% of indigenous adults. Over here, 10 to around 30% of indigenous adults. And here, indigenous residents. And here, 30% or more indigenous residents here in this right column. So these are the higher indigenous communities and the lower indigenous communities. And what you can see here is, for example, communities with a higher percentage of indigenous adults have about 30% of them have most of the roads paved, compared to around 60% of communities which have a low percentage of indigenous residents. You see the same basic patterns for these other indicators that we used. So in terms of the high indigenous communities, about 10% has public transportation, at seven times higher in communities with a low percentage of indigenous residents. Same thing for median household expenditure. There's a large difference there, and you really kind of see it with these very high indigenous communities. A lot of the differences you see once the percentage gets at about 30% or above. So just a lot less development in higher indigenous communities. So here is the prevalence. These are unadjusted prevalence of obesity and diabetes, and this is at the individual level, so this is among indigenous versus non-indigenous adults, and as you can see, so these are both significant at the 0.05 level. So indigenous adults, about 21% of them are obese versus 28% of non-indigenous adults. And for diabetes, 4% of indigenous adults versus 7% of non-indigenous adults. So here are, this is obesity and diabetes prevalence in all adults in communities based on the percent of indigenous residents. So over here, let's see if I can get this to work again. Yeah. So these are the highest indigenous communities, so about 30% of adults with the highest share of indigenous residents, 20% are obese, versus about 28% in those with lower percentages of indigenous residents. So these are all adults. In terms of diabetes, you see a more linear relationship. So the communities with 30% or more indigenous adults, 5% of all residents have diabetes relative to higher percentages in these communities that have a lower share of indigenous residents. And these are also, these are different from one another at 0.05. So this is different from this, and this is different from this. And here, only obesity is, only the highest indigenous is different. These two are not different here. So these are the adjusted models. So these are odds ratios of obesity. And these, what we're doing here is I'll walk you through the modeling sequence. So we have the individual level here in the first row, which is indigenous versus the reference category, which is not indigenous. And down here, this is the community percent indigenous, and it's measured per 10% of indigenous residents. So the modeling sequence that we use, so in the first model, we just looked at indigenous status with some basic controls. In the second model, we added the indicators of individual level SES. In the third model, we added percent of residents in the community that were indigenous. And in the fourth model, we added community development indicators. So in terms, let's look first at this first row here. So as you can see, the odds ratio is 0.70. That means that indigenous adults are about 30% less likely to be obese than non-indigenous adults. And that doesn't change here in Model 2 when we account for their socioeconomic disadvantage through occupation, their household economic status, and so on. So basically, this is just confirming lower obesity, lower odds of obesity in indigenous than non-indigenous adults. And here in Model 3, let's look here at community percent indigenous per 10% here. So the odds ratio is 0.93, so that means for every 10% increase in the percentage of residents who are indigenous, the odds of obesity lowers by about 7%. So between communities with zero versus about 30%, you'd see about a 20% decrease in the odds of obesity, and that's above and beyond individual indigenous status. So something going on there at the community level. And the interesting thing here also is that once we account for community percent indigenous, the odds ratios for indigenous versus non-indigenous adults, that gap shrinks. So that suggests that what indigenous status is capturing in part is probably the propensity of indigenous adults to live in communities with a higher percentage of indigenous residents. So there may be some community level effect that we're seeing over here, but the difference is still statistically significantly different between the two. So in Model 4, we add those indicators of community development that I talked about, and as you can see, the odds ratios don't change much, so that means that there really isn't much explanation of these differences by community development. So we see basically the same patterns for diabetes. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but you can see lower odds of diabetes among indigenous than non-indigenous adults here, very little explained by socioeconomic status. There's also a lower odds of diabetes in communities with a higher percent indigenous. And again, you see that it explains part of the effect of individual indigenous status. And when we add community development indicators, we don't see much change at all. So in summary, indigenous status and a higher percentage of indigenous residents in communities is associated with lower obesity and diabetes risk among Mexican adults. And these are not attributable to differences in SES or community development. So these patterns contrast with those that are found in higher income countries, where indigenous adults have a higher, not lower, burden of both obesity and diabetes than non-indigenous adults. So we were unable to explain this advantage in Mexico. It may be that SES and community development are not the answer, but it may be that the variables that we included in the analysis don't accurately measure the SES of indigenous adults. It may be that our measure of household economic status, for example, which accounted for the level of food expenditure in households, may not have captured lower access to calories or even food insufficiency in indigenous households. It may also be that our indicators at the community level for development were insufficient to capture lower development in those communities. For example, our measure of road development did not measure full road capacity. And I mention that because it's very important that we discount any kind of socioeconomic explanation before we, or in addition to trying to identify alternative mechanisms, because you're really talking about different intervention. If this is due to lower SES, then we need to think about what's going to happen to Indigenous adults as their socioeconomic status rises. Mexico's undergoing a lot of poverty alleviation programs right now. And so if increased socioeconomic status is associated with greater obesity and diabetes prevalence, then we would need to know that and think about interventions. But it may be that there are alternative mechanisms at work, and it's important that we identify them. Cultural resources is one that is likely. Indigenous populations have struggled to maintain cultural distinction in Mexico. This may foster stronger Indigenous identity, norms, and values. It may enable Indigenous adults to sustain traditional lifestyles, for example, through sharing knowledge around preparation and production of Indigenous foods, which are less energy dense. Migration also differs by Indigenous status and also by the kind of community concentration of Indigenous adults, and that may affect community level mechanisms that might be linked to these outcomes. So in general, more research needed to rule out socioeconomic and development hypotheses and to explore alternative mechanisms. And also just a word about genetic mechanisms. So obesity and diabetes have genetic as well as environmental determinants. So there's been a lot of research that has been investigating genetic susceptibility to obesity and diabetes in Indigenous populations, especially in, contrasting groups with similar genotypes in high and low income settings. So it's been speculated that some ethnic groups have an energy conserving genotype that enables efficient food utilization in eras of frequent food shortages. But this could predispose them to obesity and insulin resistance in the presence of an increased food supply. But results from this analysis support the notion that environmental determinants may counterbalance any genetic risk for obesity and diabetes in Indigenous populations. And that's consistent with conclusions from some of the genetic research that I've talked about. So in terms of limitations, I'm just going to go over a few of them. We couldn't rule out healthcare-related mechanisms for diabetes, which was self-reported, but we did do a sensitivity analysis that was limited to just adults with health insurance, and we found similar patterns. They weren't quite as strong, but the same patterns that we saw when we included the full population. Also, the results for obesity, which was based on objective measurements, lend confidence to the results for diabetes. Results may be biased if there was misclassification of Indigenous status. So if non-reporting of Indigenous status was correlated with higher obesity or diabetes risk. And Mexico's Indigenous population is diverse. We use sort of a pan-ethnic definition, so results may not apply equally to subgroups or to indigenous populations in other countries. So just in closing, if there's an urgent need for research that uncovers the sources of Indigenous advantage at the individual and community levels, and our findings imply that there may be a window of opportunity to prevent the wide disparities in obesity and diabetes by Indigenous status seen in high-income countries from developing in Mexico. And it may be that Mexico is not on the same trajectory towards those disparities that we see in higher-income settings, but given that we're seeing severe disparities in Indigenous status by other health outcomes in Mexico, I think it's an important cautionary step to consider increased prevention in Indigenous populations and communities. So with increasing urbanization in Mexico and generational shifts in lifestyles, the opportunity may soon be lost to prevent disparities from developing and to capture insights around protective mechanisms that may yield benefits not just for Indigenous Mexicans, but for the broader Mexican population and for other populations globally. And there's also a need for additional research on obesity and diabetes by Indigenous status in other lower and middle income countries in the region, both in terms of identifying opportunities for disparities prevention and uncovering sources of Indigenous advantage. Thank you. And we have just finished this paper, so I haven't uploaded it yet, but I'm gonna try to do that. And if you're interested, you can also email me at this address and I'll send you a copy. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions, not too bad. Yes.
Can you go back to your table one?
Sure. Let's see. I wonder how I do that. Let's try this. Yeah.
I was just looking at your standard deviations under the consumption and expenditure.
Yeah, so it's skewed. You're right, this variable is skewed. So we didn't end up, there's just a very large spread. So I should have probably presented like the.
Actually, the spread is blood through the blood.
Yes, it does happen. It does happen sometimes. Right, right. Yeah, it does actually happen sometimes with these very skewed variables, and I looked it up when this happened, and I can't remember the explanation, but I can certainly get back to you about that. But there is just, it's just a really, Mexico's has high inequality, you may know, so it's just a lot of inequality in terms of the high and the low end, not just in the indigenous population, but in the non-indigenous population as well. So I probably should have presented the median and maybe the interquartile range for that.
Yeah, but it means that.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, that's something. Is there something there you think we should be modeling differently or considering?
I would be concerned, yeah, since your two distributions, the mean is not very, has what, 8,000 difference there.
Okay.
But the distributions overlap significantly.
Okay. Yeah, and one thing we could think about is just maybe modeling it in a nonlinear way. We did put this in as a linear variable, and we didn't find much improvement in fit when we looked in quartiles, but that's maybe something we could think about as well. That's a good suggestion. Yes?
I was curious if you looked at the difference in reporting of indigenous status, if that showed any effect in the language definition of indigenous status versus the self-report.
So it's generally almost completely a subset of, one's the subset of the other. So indigenous language is a subset of identification with an indigenous group. So what we did do, I didn't think I'd have time today, but turns out that we did, so, but I didn't include the slides. We did the same analysis, we reran everything with indigenous status defined as language ability. So that meant that people who identified as non-indigenous, or sorry, as indigenous, but did not speak an indigenous language were actually identified as non-indigenous in that analysis. And the results were the same, except that the odds ratios were, the gap between the two groups was even stronger. So that, you know, could indicate, it's a more conservative definition. It could indicate, like, for example, greater socioeconomic disadvantage among people who speak an indigenous language versus maybe people who are a little bit more, have a more modern lifestyle and don't speak that language, maybe just self-identify as indigenous. But there could also be stronger cultural identity and norms and values going on. But yes, we did look at that, and the results were really similar. That's a good question. Yes? Mm-hmm. So I think, so we didn't look at that. I think this is a great survey, and so I think that's it's a good next step. And I think as a next step, we'll look at migration in general. I didn't think about remittances, actually. So that would just be, it should, though, be captured in our measure of household economic status. Let me think about that. You know, it wouldn't, but it would be captured in that kind of measure. It measures like, do you have a motorized vehicle, and what's the market value of that motorized vehicle right now? And so that, if there were remittances, I would assume that it would be spent on food and spent on goods and services. So it's possible that that's captured, but that might be something for us to look at. And there is a difference, I think, in there's more migration, I believe, in non-Indigenous adults than Indigenous adults in Mexico. So that's something we should look at. Any other questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Mexico?
Yeah. Should I say a little more about that?
Yeah.
Sure. So this survey didn't collect data on like individual level diet. I think in the next round they're doing something with mothers, I believe. So that's just a hypothesis that we had that cultural resources might, because they might be associated with more traditional diets in the region, which tend to be lower in fats, higher in whole grains, that kind of thing, that those, that kind of cultural identification, cultural resources in those populations might end up with consumption of more traditional, healthier diets, and that might be explaining what we're seeing here. We did look at a couple of indicators which were really crude proxies for something we thought could be cultural resources. We looked at interactions with age, for example. So the indigenous, being indigenous was more strongly associated with older age, this protective effect. We saw it more in older indigenous adults than younger, and that for diabetes only, and that we were thinking that could indicate, you know, older populations, less exposure to acculturation pressures. We also saw a stronger advantage for indigenous individuals who lived in rural areas than in more urban areas. And we thought that also could be indicator of less, it's very commonly used proxy for less exposure to acculturation pressures. So we saw that for obesity. So it may, there may be something in this cultural hypothesis. We don't really have much more than those kind of crude variables. And also those variables themselves could be indicators of differences in socioeconomic status between indigenous and non-indigenous adults, you know, at older ages or in rural areas. So that's about as good as we could do with this. But I think that's a really important next step for research, because if there is, there are cultural resources in really severely socioeconomically disadvantaged populations like this, it might, you know, have some lessons in terms of obesity prevention, diabetes prevention.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions. Sure.
Yeah, we controlled for age. Well, we didn't match for age, but we controlled for age in the model, so that's about, she's about the same
you
thing.
Did, 'cause I was wondering, yes. If you, so uh-huh. The younger group.
Okay, no.
Yeah, if we matched for that, I assumed
you did. But. We did control for age, and then we looked for what's called an interaction by age. So that's something different. But we just, in these main models, we took account of age. So age wouldn't be like a confounder. But we did find a stronger relationship for a stronger protective effect among older indigenous adults versus younger indigenous adults.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah, but who knows what that means, but yeah.
The other, a couple of things that I wanted, and you also matched, your groups were matched by gender as well?
We controlled for gender, yeah.
Controlled for gender. And the one thing, I think you were trying to do it indirectly with the occupation, but did you look at energy expenditure?
No, and that'd be great. That's, I think, was our hypothesis behind that. Mm-hmm. So the assumption is that indigenous groups are more likely to work in agriculture that has higher energy expenditure. So it's more like a proxy for that energy expenditure.
Right.
Yeah.
It's
energy expenditure.
How much energy expenditure.
Yeah, and you know, we didn't find that it explained what's going on, but it could be. There's a couple things to think about there, I think. First, which is that discrimination might result. So these are really broad categories here in terms of occupational status. So let's say that you were indigenous and your category is agriculture, but within that category you might be assigned to a worse job, a more physically demanding job than a non-indigenous person because of a discrimination, just power differentials. And so this wouldn't be picking that up. And so that's why I think we need to look more closely. With this survey, that's not possible. This is all we could do. But if you had something that got at job assignments, then you would be, that would be really future research, I mean, additional data collection. then that might be explaining this difference that we see. It's just that these broad kind of crude categories didn't pick that up. And that's why I think it's really important to look a little more closely. But yeah, that's what we're thinking in terms of energy expenditure. On the cultural resources side, it could be that it's a clearer pathway to diet, but it could be that there are traditional ways of living and farming in among indigenous individuals that are maintained through culture and it results in greater energy expenditure, walking to visit people versus taking cars. I mean, who knows? That could be accounting for it on the cultural level too. So I don't want to rule either of those out. I think it's kind of next steps.
Is that, does that conclude all the questions on the presentation?
Okay, thank you. Sure.
With our two presenters, we're sort of seeing the extremes of the malnutrition, nutrition topics that are hot now in the field of international health and nutrition, which is what we're really looking at. The first one was looking at a new, it's a more refined way of a new way of looking at the behavioral aspects of malnutrition in low resource settings, which is we're looking much more closely now than simply explaining by national food production or food availability, a lot more of these factors that help us to refine our methodologies and how to actually help the situation. And our second presenter helped refine a lot more of the real hot topic, which is this issue of obesity and diabetes. There is one that blends both of them, which is the stunting that comes with chronic malnutrition and looking at those children as they grow up and how many of them later become obese and develop diabetes. So that's the frontiers of research, and there's a lot of subcategories in that. I want to thank our two presenters for some very thorough and thought-provoking presentations. I'm going away with a lot of new ideas, and I thank all of you for coming, getting up early and coming in for our presentation today. And we'll conclude now. And our presenters will be around for a couple more minutes. One of them has another session she has to run to, but I think we're finishing a little early, so please feel free to come up and talk to us individually. And again, I'd like to give a round of applause to both of our presenters.